Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris.
Hey, hey, how we doing, guys? Apologies in advance. My voice is a little raspy. Got a cold from my son. He's three, so I can't really blame him too much. But anyway, I digress. Let's get to the show. By the way, during the interview, my voice will not be as raspy because it was taped a while ago. And I'm really excited about this interview. I know I say that every week, but I really mean it every week. And in this case, I mean it in an especially powerful and poignant way because Ruth King is among, if not the best person I've ever spoken to about how to address perhaps the most painful issue in American public life and one of the most painful issues on the planet, which is race. And she just has an incredible way of talking about it and the role that meditation can play in helping us have successful dialogues. I say this not only as a result of having sat with her to do this interview, but I've spent some time with her personally, and she just has a way about her that just oozes intelligence and reasonableness, if that's even a word, and compassion. So she's got a new book called Mindfulness of Race that I recommend. And during the course of this interview, we're going to talk about the fact that she's done racial awareness work with, you know, major corporations like Levi Strauss and Intel. So she's really been on the front lines of this for a long time. She's also a longtime meditation teacher. And I ask her straight up, you know, what about some of my fear about addressing this stuff as a white man who, you know, has a certain amount of financial and cultural power? You know, how can I discuss this, you know, without putting my foot in my mouth? And, you know, her answers are fascinating and really helpful to me. So all that is coming up. First, though, I just want one quick item of business, and then we'll do your voicemails. The business is that our guest next week is Oren Sofer, who is one of the most popular teachers on our app, the 10% Happier app. And in advance of him coming on the show next week, we've put up a couple of new meditations from him on the app. One of them is about a topic that's kind of near and dear to my heart these days, which is self-empathy, which can sound a little gooey, you know, being nice to yourself, blah, blah, blah. But I've learned through my practice recently where I've been getting into a little bit more of this, of sort of compassion practices, which I've talked about on the show before. They're a little bit annoying, at least at first, but they are, I think, incredibly powerful and will be the subject or at the core of the book I'm working on right now. And so he's got one on self-empathy, which is really just about how to get through tough situations. And I've always been of the view that the way to get through tough situations is to beat the crap out of yourself. It turns out I've been wrong about that. So this is a meditation that goes right at that. And that's one of two meditations we'll be posting on the app that are up on the app right now. So check them out and then check out Oren on the show next week. All right, let's do your voicemails. Here's number one.
Hey, Dan, this is Scott from Orlando. I'm just curious what you think about the importance of having some sort of a community or someone to bounce your ideas off of as you move forward in your practice and as you're learning. For myself right now, I really am only learning through the podcast and a couple of books, yours included, very good. But I do not have a teacher, and I don't have really anyone else around me that's kind of into this. So I'm just curious what you think about that importance. Thanks a lot. Love everything you're doing. Bye.
Thank you. You know, this is a question we've tackled before on the show, so I'll get through it reasonably quickly because I know that the next question is quite meaty. But yeah, I think teachers are incredibly useful, but not a must. So I spent the first year of my meditation practice just reading books. There was no podcast that I was aware of. I don't think I even listened to podcasts at that time. I read a bunch of books and, you know, I went to a few because I'm in New York City, which is such a privilege to be in New York City where there are lots of events you can go to where you can hear from teachers. And that was really useful. I was really practicing on my own. And it was before, this is 2009, so I think it was before any of the meditation apps were out there. I just practicing on my own based on the basic instructions for mindfulness meditation are pretty simple. And I thought it was fine. But my practice really took off when I went to my first retreat, which again, I always talk about retreats gingerly because it's not a must. A lot of you listen to the show are of the view that you don't have the time or maybe even the resources to go on retreat, and that's fine. I really, as anybody who's listened to the show for any period of time knows, I think even if you're doing a minute or two most days, then you're getting a lot of the benefits. So I don't want to push you or by extension any of the listeners to get more aggressive than you need to be. So it's a very individual decision. But if you're up for it, finding a teacher can be incredibly powerful and really depends on where you live. Do you have access? Most major cities now have meditation centers of one flavor or another. Secular centers are popping up in New York and L.A., Austin, Texas, Miami, Chicago, I believe in Chicago. And then there are more Buddhist-y places, which, again, I don't think you need to be afraid of the Buddhist thing. I think they teach really solid meditation techniques in these spots, most of them, at least the ones I've been to. And if you don't like the smells and bells of it, if there even are smells and bells and formal sort of Buddhist ceremonies, you can ignore that stuff and just focus in on the instruction. But I think the ability to ask questions of an experienced teacher, either one-on-one or raising your hand and asking questions from a crowd, the benefits are you know, incalculable. To really be able to run by an individual who spent a lot of time traveling down the various byways of the mind, what you're experiencing, and they'll, you know, if they're a good teacher, they're going to recognize it right away and be able to give you a couple of options. So if it's available to you, if there are teachers in your neighborhood, or if you find one who's available on Skype, I would say go for it. The other thing I would recommend is if you're on the app, and I know from the survey work we've done that a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are on the 10% Happier app, we have these coaches. Some of the happiest and most frequent users of the app are the people who talk to our coaches. These people, the coaches, are experienced meditators. They live to answer your questions. You can ask them as many questions as you want, free of charge once you're a subscriber. So take advantage of that. And these people, this you will be deriving a lot of the benefits of having a teacher by talking to these coaches. Thank you for that question. Let's get on to voicemail number two.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for all that you and your team have done in bringing meditation and mindfulness to so many people. You've certainly changed this 33-year-old's life. My question is that, in one of Joseph Goldstein's guided meditations on fear in the 10% Happier app, which I am a happy subscriber, he mentions how important it is to fully accept negative emotions like fear rather than to resist them. And he even tells us a personal story about it. In some situations for me, this works like a charm, and the negative feeling does seemingly miraculously dissolve, and it's amazing. But in others, my anxiety is so fierce that if I start, quote-unquote, accepting it, it enlarges so much that it almost feels like I'm going to be drowned in it, like completely overwhelmed in my seat and that I might even fall off. And I don't know if I can go through with it. So what I do is I then clamp down once it gets to a certain point. So my question is, have you experienced this before, and how do you deal with it? I'm not sure that these types of negative feelings have the chance to go away if I keep clamping down and resist them at a certain point. And maybe the point is I shouldn't try to assume that they'll or want them to ultimately go away, which is Joseph's point, but I'm not sure I can even get to the point of allowing them in because it's just so overwhelming and so large. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you. That's a great question. I've been thinking a lot about this because actually we're making a change in the way we're making a number of changes in the way we handle the voicemail section on this podcast. The first change we're making is that heretofore, I have not heard the questions in advance. We ran a podcast listener survey a few months ago, and 500 of you took a lot of time and answered really detailed questions. I am so grateful for that. One of the pieces of feedback we got was that, why aren't you listening to the voicemails in advance so that you can give us more thoughtful answers? Pretty good piece of feedback. So now I'm going to be doing that. And I think in the future, we're actually going to be bringing in, because one of the things I was often saying in my answers was, you know, I'm not an expert, but here's my take on it. We're actually, in some cases, going to bring in experts and pipe in their answers to your questions. So stay tuned for more changes to come. Anyway, so I, a long way of saying I've been able to think a little bit about that question because I knew it was coming. And let me just first talk a little bit about the guided meditation that she references from Joseph Goldstein. This guided meditation from Joseph is on, it's called Fear. If you search for it in the app, you can find it. It's excellent. Talks a lot about it, the fact that Joseph, for many years in his life, even after a long time of meditating, was dealing with serious doses of fear, both in his walking around life and in his meditation practice. But he found that he started to realize that the attitude in his mind toward the difficult emotion of fear was, I will be mindful of you. I will try to note that you're here. But there's this undercurrent of, I want you to go away. He calls this, I don't know if he says this in the meditation, but he calls this often in many of his speeches, in order to mind. That we think we're being mindful of a difficult emotion, but really, if we look closely, there's this subtle element of aversion. We're being mindful in order for that emotion to go away. And that isn't real acceptance. And I'm not saying this with a wagging finger. Acceptance is hard, and this is a skill that we are training. And sometimes it's doable, as we heard in that excellent question. Sometimes it is doable. Sometimes we, you know, an emotion arises, and we are able to summon some mindfulness. We're okay with the feeling, and it does have a way of going away, or we just become okay with it, and that being okay with it, it changes the nature and the force, the valence of the emotion. However, there are times in my experience where it's just too strong. If you have an anxiety disorder, in my case, I have panic disorder. I'm not of the view that I can meditate my way out of panic, that I can sit and just allow. I am not a good enough meditator yet to watch panic arise and pass. I can't do it. But that is, you know, I am and we are all training this skill. And so over time, I would argue, you will get better at allowing this intense anxiety to just be there. But think about how far you've come, that you're able at times now, at age 33, I don't know how long you've been meditating, to see sometimes the anxiety arise and to say, oh yeah, I see it. Here it is. I'm okay with it. And that it can sometimes dissipate, or you can just be okay with it and not be paralyzed by it. That's a huge achievement. That sometimes it is too strong for you. I don't know what you mean by clamping down in order to stop it, but that sometimes it's too strong for you. I guess my opinion is that's okay. And you're just going to get better and better over time at this skill of true mindfulness, which has an aspect of acceptance. So I would say bravo to you and keep doing the work. And I would really be interested to hear, and this is an improvement we're going to make over time. As I said in our voicemail section of the show, I would be interested to hear what somebody like Joseph or a meditation with teacher would say about exactly what to do in the moment where it's too strong. But personally, I'll tell you what I would do, which is if I was experiencing sometimes for me, restlessness is the thing that I can sit with it. You know, the physical discomfort of restlessness, I can sit with it for a certain period of time, but after a while, I have to stand up. I reach my breaking point. And I've talked about this with Joseph, and he's talked about this too with physical pain with me. You know, sometimes you experiencing physical discomfort unrelated to restlessness, or restlessness that produces a kind of physical discomfort. And he says that, you know, we're training the ability to sit with this. You want to test your edge here, but at some point it's too much, and it's okay to stand up. And in my case, I'll continue the session of meditation while standing up. And so over time, I'm just continuously, I hope, getting better at accepting and being with these difficult sensations. But, you know, at a certain point, it's just too much. So that's my advice. My overall advice is you're doing a great job. Keep at it, and you will continue to improve over time. I do want to say one other thing, and I know I'm giving a long answer to this, but, you know, I've been doing. I'm really, really quite deep now in the research into my next book, tentatively entitled 10% Nicer, although I don't know if that's what the title will be. But it's really about kindness. And I've been doing a lot of metta, M-E-T-T-A meditation, loving kindness meditation. And I was on a retreat recently with the teacher Spring Washam, who's been on this show twice and is incredible. We did a one-on-one a loving kindness retreat. And I had a lot of really powerful insights during the course of that retreat. And one of them is directly germane to this discussion about acceptance. What I found was that for me, a lot of the difficult emotions I deal with during meditation are restlessness and impatience. I just don't want to be doing the meditation. And when I'm on retreat, I don't want to be on the retreat. And I'd never actually been fully mindful of that before. And what was interesting about seeing these difficult emotions arise within the context of metta or loving kindness, which is often, I think, better translated as friendliness, this kind of meditation where you're cultivating friendliness. Just as a brief aside, the technique here, as many of you will know this, but for those of you who don't, the technique here is you are systematically envisioning people, including yourself, and repeating phrases of well-wishing. So may you be happy, may you be safe, may you live with ease, et cetera, et cetera. And so you're doing this really annoying practice, but over time, it's that you actually start to generate this feeling of friendliness. And within the once you've created this kind of container of mental friendliness, once these difficult emotions arise, in my case, restlessness, sometimes anger, frustration, first of all, I'm more mindful. I'm seeing it because the mind is tuned up, and I'm actually accepting it with some friendliness. And this, to me, meditation teachers talk about this all the time, that it's not just enough to note with some non-judgmental remove whatever emotion or sensation you're experiencing, but to do so with some friendliness and warmth. Well, I always ignored the latter part of that instruction because I didn't really know what it meant. But on this retreat where the mind is flooded with this friendliness, I realized, oh, yeah, actually, I can have some warmth. It doesn't mean I'm psyched that I'm feeling so restless I want to run away, but I can see it as blow it a kiss. So that has made a big difference for me in terms of accepting all of the difficult emotions and physical sensations that arise inevitably in any meditation practice. So I've said a lot. I hope it was useful. Let me get now to somebody who really knows what she's talking about, Ruth King, our guest this week. I said a bit about her at the beginning. She is, just as a reminder, a longtime teacher in the insight meditation tradition. She's written a couple of books on the issue of race. The newest one's called Mindful of Race. She also wrote a book about rage, which is a powerful emotion that arises for many people in discussions of race. And so she is going to... She's going to drop a lot of knowledge on us in this podcast. I'm really grateful to her for coming on. So here she is, Ruth King. Great to see you.
Yes.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
So as I warned you in advance, I'm going to ask this question. How did you get into the meditation game?
Yeah. Well, I'll make this story brief because it's really rich. I was in China.
Well, let me just say, don't make it brief. This is a podcast.
All right.
Brevity is not rewarded here.
Okay, good. That's even better. So I'm in China at the Beijing Women's Conference back in the late 80s, early 90s. I can't remember the year.
When you were 7 years old.
I wasn't seven, but I was an adult. And I went to that conference and did a training on generational healing and met a woman when I was there. Who we were both black women staring at this five-story golden Buddha with tears kind of running down our eyes for no apparent reason. And she turns to me and she says, do you meditate? And I said, well, kinda. And she says, where do you live? And of course, in China, I said, well, I live in the Bay Area. And only people in the Bay Area would say they live in the Bay Area in China, assuming everybody knows where that is. But she said, so do I. And so So as it turns out, she was on the board of Spirit Rock, and she said, I want you to come and join me. I want you to be with me. I need you there. And I said, well, she's talking about diversity.
Tell us what Spirit Rock is.
Spirit Rock Meditation Community in Woodacre, California, which is Northern California. And so I was living in Berkeley, and which is across the bay. And I said, you know, I'm just not feeling like I'm up for all this diversity stuff again. I've kind of been there, done that. She wanted me to join the Diversity Council there and just support the awakening that was starting to happen there. But I went to a meditation class with her teacher, Jack Kornfield, on a Monday night, this crowded room. I fell in love with Jack Kornfield, basically. He offered a teaching that evening where he started off saying, nobly born, remember who you are. Be willing to know for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Know for yourself. And there was something about that message that I think I had been looking for in a spiritual practice that made my heart just crack wide open, because I wanted to know for myself. I didn't want to just trust somebody blindly and hear the good faith message without it being an embodied kind of spirituality. So there was something about that that kind of cracked me open, had me relax, had me believing that there was something more I could do to attend to my distress, which I was basically just grinning and bearing and, you know, having positive thoughts, but really struggling on the inside. So Spirit Rock Meditation Community became my sangha, my community where I practice. And I've been there ever since.
Let's just go into that, the know for yourself part of it, because I think that is the, I don't know if I'm mangling the Buddha's words here, but something around along the lines of knowing for yourself.
Exactly.
Because I think there is, one of the reasons why people are attracted to Buddhism, I'll speak for myself at least, is that it isn't somebody telling you, hey, you got to accept my dogma. Basically like, hey, the Buddha himself said this, which was, hey, look, I'm going to make some metaphysical claims. You can take them or leave them.
That's right.
But just try out this meditation thing. If it works for you, then you can keep doing it.
That's right. And, you know, it's coming from being raised in a Baptist church where church was really where the community lived, you know. I don't know if I saw everybody practicing the faith, but it was where the community hung out. It was where you took care of Sarah and her family who had the drug problem, or the fathers who got laid off work. We, you know, there was all this sense of community. And it wasn't so much about the teachings of the Bible as much as it was about community. And so there was a lot around faith, believe in God, put your faith in God, which is nothing wrong with it. A good friend of mine says, the Lord is Jesus is my Lord and personal Savior, but the Buddha left instructions. I think there was something about the instructions of how to embody faith, how to know for yourself, how to relax into the experiences, the moments, the accumulation of moments where you get a taste, a potent homeopathic drop of freedom and release that really carries you to a place of really knowing what you're capable of letting go of. So that was really powerful for me, those moments that have accumulated over the years where there's faith in what I'm capable of understanding in my mind that supports freedom, not freedom as a destination, not freedom as heaven, but freedom each moment when I can let go of some entrenched stronghold on my heart and mind that interferes with me seeing clearly and opening to what's here right now.
You mentioned your childhood going to church. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Central Los Angeles in the heat of the civil rights movement and Black Power movements of that time. My family was very active in the civil rights movement, primarily the NAACP, the Urban League. And we all watched and was involved kind of peripherally in that very potent time. And so I grew up in South Central Los Angeles and, you know, in Watts. And there's the church was big, but jazz was also big, as well as the civil rights movement. So there was this interesting blend of, again, improvisational jazz was a big part of growing up, where we had these jam sessions at home, and my mother played the piano, so all the other instruments had to come to our house. And I think what I saw was this palpable, deep listening, attuning, creating stream that was running through all of the struggles of civil rights and all of the despair that we saw in communities with struggling families. There was jazz. There was improvisational jazz. So there was a richness in listening and attuning to the collective, which is what jazz does. And so that was a beautiful stream that was running as well. It was really a sense of creativity and connection and listening and creating something together that you couldn't possibly do by yourself. So that's a big influence in my life, is being raised in South Central.
Well, let me go back to the Golden Buddha for a moment. Yeah. When you're standing where were you, in China?
And we're in, yeah.
You're looking at a Golden Buddha.
In Beijing.
Two questions about that. One is, why were you crying? And two, When your new friend said, I need you to join me on the board because, I'm assuming she was saying I'm one of the few, if not the only African-Americans on here, and it's mostly white. And you said, I don't want to do that because I don't want to do more of this diversity stuff.
Yeah.
So you could answer those in whatever order you want, but I'm curious about both of those things.
Well, the tears, I think, for both of us, she's since passed away. Dr. Marlene Schoonover Jones, who was very big in trying to bring more diversity and racial awareness to the Buddhist communities. So I, you know, bows to her for that. But I think we were both in tears because of the majesty of this statue. It was huge. It was golden. A lot of the imagery of the Buddha is this sense of stillness, equanimity, quietude, you know. And I think there's just a hunger and longing for, there's a recognition that this is something deeply, this is the thirst to a large extent that we have. And yet it was so palpable. I mean, I think for me, I could see myself. I've had dreams of sitting and being in that still posture way before I even knew what Buddhism was. So there was a recognition. And I think along with it was an offer of something that you could do. You could sit, you could be serene. You know, this is touchable, tasteable. That was my experience. And just being so relieved in a way to see that and to be touched by something so simple yet so profound.
And your reluctance?
Well, my reluctance is my whole career, my professional career was in corporations doing diversity training and leadership development programs and coaching leaders on, you know, how to wake up to the power and group dynamics and diversity, the skeletal shape of, power dynamics that happens inside of corporations, the obliviousness around issues of race and our intent and impact. So I did that work for many, many years, and I was just retiring from it. I was just around that time leaving Intel Corporation and Levi Strauss, where I did quite a bit of work, and deciding to pursue more of a stillness practice. I wasn't even sure what it was at the time, but I knew I was done with this grind of pushing against the system and efforting and trying to get people to wake up that really weren't that interested really around these issues. But I was interested in it, but interested in addressing it in a different way. There had to be, in my mind, a way of addressing this kind of internal struggle without efforting so much, without burning out. Too many people I knew had died early, diabetes, had all these, you know, these worrying warrior black people that I knew, and other races as well, people of color primarily, who were just dying way too young from stress and rage and it just was not going to be my life. I just decided it was not going to be my life. So when I met Dr. Jones, who was inviting me to come back into kind of addressing some of the institutional things, is like, I've been there, I've done that. I don't want to do that. I ended up doing that anyway.
And by the way, continuing with the corporate work, right?
And continuing to some sense with the corporate work, but bringing mindfulness into the corporate work. And so that limited my options, of course, but that was okay because the work was really juicy to work with corporate leaders that were really interested in how to integrate their habits of mind, the way they think, their conditioning around race and diversity, to kind of wake up with that, to that right in the middle of corporations. But I was, I don't do a lot of corporate work anymore, but I do work with a lot of teams and organizations and groups that want to deepen their relationship with race, their racial conditioning, want to unpack it, examine it closely to really see what their, thread is in this tapestry of racial tension that just keeps being a repetitive motion injury in our social system.
So would it be fair to say that the introduction of meditation into this work of diversity revolutionized the work for you?
I think it did for me personally. I totally think it was kind of a real deal changer for me.
How so?
Well, I think mainly because it's that know for yourself piece. But the other piece for me was really recognizing the impact that my actions had on collective well-being. It wasn't enough for me to be right and rageful because I was planting seeds with all of my actions. There was something about knowing that my drop from my energy and effort and pointing things out, when it was twinged in hate and righteousness, I was planting more seeds of that. And there was something disturbing about that on the inside, that it was just, doing harm just was no longer an option in me. I got in touch with just how much I was hurting too, in the ways that I was so righteous and angry about what I was seeing. I mean, I was really good at pointing these things out. I was trained well, and I was right, but there was a way I was dead right. I was dead on the inside. I was shut down. You know, when you're so right about something, when you're so fixated on it, then something's always left out of view. you can't have a tight focus like that without shutting something out. And because I had open heart surgery at the age of 27 from a mitral valve prolapse, which I think was related to how I had been living my life up to that point, and a lot of stress, a lot of rage, a lot of anger. There was just something about the heart has always been integral in my life. You know, I was tenderhearted growing up. I was a crybaby. You know, I was very sensitive as a child and highly controlled in my family. There were eight of us, so there was a lot of high control. And I had to silence myself for a number of years. And there's a lot of violence, both inside the family and outside in the community around us. So there was ways I had to silence my rage in order to survive. And then when I became of age or an adult, I started raging all over the place. So I just feel like that just accelerated a certain kind of chemistry inside my heart and mind that just put my heart at risk. And it was enlarged, and there needed to be surgery. And then there was the recovery, which was my first silent retreat, where I didn't have any energy to defend myself anymore. And there was that was a profound experience of gentling and softening and healing from all of the things I'd been running from, all of the things I was not really willing to face, you know. So there's a lot to my upbringing that was also in the mix of knowing I needed to find another way. You know, like I remember my great-grandmother pacing when I was 7 years old. She died. She paced a lot and worried a lot. She couldn't help. She couldn't protect the black bodies in our family that were going to prison and being harassed. And so there was this atmosphere of fear and worry, but not the skills to be able to work gently and bring the heart into the mix of this. And I remember how hard it was that I couldn't comfort her at the age of seven. And when she died, I remember saying to myself, you know, I'm just not going out like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just something about that. I can't do it that way. I couldn't comfort her. And that was a real moment. And I think she'd be happy to know I'm doing walking meditation these days instead of pacing the floor in worry. I really am not worried like I used to be. That's one of the things about meditation. You can kind of look back on your life, and it's usually in the practice you can look back and say, oh, I'm not dealing with that like I used to. Oh, I didn't react to that the way I used to. Sometimes it's this retrospection, this kind of view of really looking back that helps you see that you're really handling things differently with a bit more clarity, with a bit more understanding of your impact, with a deep wisdom about our belonging and that what we do really matters. We're all in the business of planting seeds. And we really need to be more conscious about what they are. So I'm not so quick to be in righteousness and, you know, like I used to be, because it's deadening.
You talked about, there were many things I want to ask you about from the paragraphs you just uttered, which were all very, very interesting. Mm. Violence in the family.
Mm-hmm.
If you're comfortable, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, there's violence in the family. My mother was a single mom of eight kids. She had been married a number of times. And the kids were in different sets. So the first three kids had a father, the second three had another father, and then the last two had different fathers. So it was like the Macaws against the Smiths.
Which set were you in?
I was in the second set. And then the first six kids were 1 year apart. So really tight, close in age. But my oldest sister ended up having to be responsible for raising us, when that's really not the job that she wanted. And so we really felt her wrath around that. She didn't like that job, so she was very hateful and really angry because she didn't get to really have a life. She wasn't that much older than us and had this settled responsibility of parenting us. She really wasn't that good at it. She wasn't interested in it, and she hated the job. And so we felt that, at least, especially the second set of kids with a different father, because there was just a struggle between whose dad was loved the most. It was complicated. But and my sister just passed away last year, and there was a lot of healing that's been done over the years. I think, again, this practice supported me in being able to return to that early imprinting of, it was violence, but it was mostly fear that I felt, and a real terror of high control, and also terror of doing something wrong, of upsetting anyone. So it was a really tightly controlled, critical environment. You know, the violence was more of threats. It was a lot of emotional violence, you know, some physical violence. But it was just an atmosphere of terror, of being afraid of speaking, of doing something wrong. You know, I was raised in that atmosphere. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, and maybe you just answered it, but I'd be curious to hear about the content of the rage you felt suffusing your life in the years before meditation. Was it about unexamined, unexplored, compartmentalized rage about the way your childhood went, or was it about the content of structural racism in America? Mm. What was it all of it?
Well, I think it's hard to separate the structural racism out of the equation because of internalized oppression. You know, I think a lot of the physical violence that African-American people especially display is the result of being so violated through generations of slavery and abuse and seeing violence as a form of control. So I think that some of that gets played out in the family setting as a way of controlling your children. I don't think it's necessarily conscious, so it's hard for me to see how to separate structural racism, internalized oppression from the equation of parenting, especially in families that struggle with day-to-day means and survivals, families that are, don't have, a lot of resources. We didn't have great educational systems. So there's a whole cycle of systemic racism that puts a lot of pressure on families. And so that gets played out. That pressure gets released in places where you can control them. I think this also happens in families that have a lot of money, but that's a whole nother story. So I do think there's that. But the rage that I felt was primarily about this high control inside my family. I think I wasn't as aware of the racism directly as it came to me. I think there was a lot of overprotection in the family.
But you were doing this work in corporations where you were pointing out the racism.
Yeah, I was doing work, but we're talking about my early... Are you talking about my early...
I was hearkening back to the rage you said you saw the disutility of, the rage you wanted to drop, which is what made meditation attractive to you.
Hmm.
And you said you were right, but dead right, which I think is
right,
such an amazing way to formulate
right. it. Yeah.
And so I'm just trying to get a sense. At that point, the Ruth King of right around the time where you're getting introduced into meditation, which is your late 20s, Late 30s, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
What was the content of your rage? Was it all about your childhood, or was it about the racism you were seeing in the world?
I think
it a mix?
Yeah, I think it was a mix. And again, these are very gradations here. But I was so good at my rage that I got a high paying consulting job that afforded me the privilege of pointing it out. You know, so my heat was well utilized inside these corporations because I was good at pointing out what was happening. What was missed in that is my unfinished business, that was underneath it, that was really feeding it. I wasn't necessarily cleaning my and licking my own wounds around this, but I was real good at pointing out, how screwed up you were, white boy, because that's kind of what the job was. And there was, interestingly enough, there was some real listening of the message I had to say. So I felt very effective in the work I was doing inside of corporations, despite the rage I had, because I was able to still point out some very obvious messages. But what wasn't happening was me being able to adapt to my own burning internal destruction that was happening in my own approach. I think I was bypassing the needs I had to heal from being controlled. My being controlled that hadn't been addressed became controlling in the work that I was doing. So it got projected under an a professional, suit wearing kind of experience.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
So I wonder specifically how you approach it differently now, because the racism's still there, and by the way, worthy of rage.
Yeah.
So how do you do this work without the rage?
Well, I think if rage can be, sometimes rage is loaded because it's just dipped in the waters of unfinished business. And, we have to look at the character of the rage because it's energy. You know, it is a certain thing that's running through that's alive and real time. So it's not to be ignored. But I think we need to pay attention to its story. I think the story of rage oftentimes belongs to us more than it belongs externally. It's old. It's usually shame-based. You know, we need to understand. My first book was on rage, by the way. So it's been a big teacher in my life, a very big teacher in my life. So, yeah, the rage is still there, but I think we become responsible for the impact we have on other people. Through meditation practice, you get tenderized to your impact, and to you get really acquainted with your habits of mind and your heart's longing. And you learn, I often say, how this life is not personal, it's not permanent. Is not perfect, you know. So when I'm in the heat of a moment, I feel like a rage moment, a racist moment, a racism moment. When I turn on the news each night, or I'm looking at the prison industrial complex and how many dark and brown bodies are in it, you know, when I see the Starbucks and the two guys and the four women, black women golfing, and the Yale black student napping, and the police are called to fix the problem because these bodies are so criminalized. I mean, I can still get pretty inflamed about it, but I think I'm more sensitive to how that energy gets used, and really choosing where it goes. I don't want to waste energy at this time of my life. It's a utility. I don't want to just spew it all over the place indiscriminately. It's very important that I use it to really make a difference. I don't want to talk to people that don't want to listen. You know, I'm not somebody that would be out there on the front lines of protests. I like to write books, and I like to deal with people that are going to be able to hear what I have to say and to be able to reflect on it. I'm not somebody that can work in this area in crisis situations, for example. My work is the places we are in before it becomes a crisis, so that we can examine how we're responding, because it's crucial. And of course, there's a lot of righteous rage out there right now around it. I think we need the fire. It's useful. It gets our attention. What we do next is what's important, what's most important.
So let's talk about the new book, Mindful of Race.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't accept my title suggestion. My title suggestion. With your phraseology, you had used, when we had breakfast a couple years ago, you used this term to describe the nature of your work, and you said, it's messy at best. I said, that's your book title. Well, you didn't listen to me, but that's fine. I'll take it personally.
But what I did do, Dan, is it's the last chapter of my book.
Oh, it is? Okay.
And it's on my wristband that says, Mindful of Race, not there yet. It's not messy at best. But it is messy. It's so messy. That would be a great book title. But it's the last chapter. What I leave people with, because I'm not trying to say, I don't want people thinking that this is going to be solved in our lifetime. This is a life's work. It's deeply ingrained in this culture. There are moments of beauty that we can learn to recognize even in the thick of it. And there's just stuff we have to do with our heart and mind in order to really turn it around. And I think that a big part of that is white people especially really recognizing that they're part of racial group identity. They are membered in whiteness, and it hasn't been examined. And when white people come to the table as just good, well-meaning individuals without being rooted in their history and lineage and how that gets played out socially, politically, then I think there's a lot missing in our potential to really graduate to real human and respectful conversations.
So let's unpack that a little bit. So as I understand it, I'm going to try to restate what you're saying, and you tell me where I go run afoul of accuracy. A lot of white people come to the table of racial dialogue thinking, you know, patting themselves on the back a little bit, thinking, well, you know, I'm a good white person. I'm participating in this. But they look around the table and everybody else is in a racial group, and they forget to notice that they too are in a racial group.
That's right. That's a big piece of it. You know, so a lot of white people I know, and I do a lot of mindful of race training. That's my primary training that I'm doing now. And a lot of white people come in, you know, well-intended and want to address race, but it's the racial other. It's how do we fix the problem? How to tell me what you need? Tell me what I don't need to understand. And I think it infuriates people of color to have to tell white people about whiteness, that they're a race, that there's a dynamic in our social realm that they're actually kind of oblivious to, this thing called whiteness. So it's such a crucial part of the equation right now that gets claimed. I was in Charlottesville. I did this training, Mindful of Race, for the Insight Meditation community there. They used this training to bridge separation in the community at large. So they invited a number of people from the community to come in and train together, learn together around this as race. It was all, the last meeting I had was with them was in preparation of them getting ready for this alt-right kind of rally that took place there in Charlottesville. And I remember after that incident where the woman was killed, the mayor said, you know, these white nationalists and people that come to our city, they just need to leave. They need to leave our fair city. And I was thinking, where in the hell are they going to go? Where are they going to go? Where do you think they go? And when white people put them out and disown them, which is, you know, a lot of that is understandable to some extent. They are somebody's mother, father, sister, brother, you know. So there's, you know, there is connection to some extent. When white people disown that kind of charge, people of color end up having to pick up the slack. They end up having to be the one that's addressing the issue, starting the movements, you know, rallying against the complexity of these very deep grooves. So this idea that they need to leave is a piece of, you know, they're not me, that's not my people, is a piece of lineage and history and membering that I think is problematic. When I get white people in a group to talk about whiteness together, they look at each other and scratch their heads. What are we going to talk about?
Well, I think it's such an interesting point because I don't think when I see people marching with tiki torches in Charlottesville, I deplore it, obviously. But I don't think, oh, there's a problem with my people. We need to address it. Whereas, just as a rough analogy, after 9/11, there was a lot of talk about the onus being on moderate Muslims to deal with radical Muslims, violent Muslims, because there was a problem with those people. It really speaks to the fact that we white people don't often see. I put myself in this category. I'm just learning about this now. Don't really think of ourselves as a group of people. We kind of think of ourselves as like the mainstream and everybody else is part of a group of people.
Yeah, that to me is a real missed opportunity, you know, because we're all individuals who've suffered and had our lives and our stories and our traumas and had to do these dances with our parents in order to get approval and to stay loved. But we're also part of racial group identities. And that's a collective experience that, you know, that people have as a race. And then all races are not created equal. There's a dominant and subordinated group dynamic around race in our country. This is a relative reality that we live in. It's not ultimate reality. It's a relative fact.
Well, some people might not know the difference between relative and ultimate reality. This is a Buddhist concept.
It's a Buddhist concept. I think it's a concept also around, you know, this idea that we all know that we're not a race, that we're, you know, that we're not just simply a race, that we're not defined and, you know, just these concepts that we live with is not totally who we are. We're more than that. But it's concepts and language and identities are ways that we navigate in our day-to-day life. But we know, especially from faith traditions and spiritual practices, that, you know, the heart is bigger than all of that. The mind is bigger than all of that. So when I'm talking about this, I'm really talking about that relative day-to-day conceptual way that we navigate our relationships, our communities, our politics, and our love, actually. You know, it's we're making choices. We're making choices based on how we've been conditioned to believe certain things and fear certain things and naturally kind of open to certain things.
So the ultimate reality is that, you know, well, I guess you could use the somewhat controversial and also very cliched term of oneness with the universe. We're all one. Mm-hmm. That you can argue about that, but let's just leave it there for a second. That would be the ultimate truth. The relative truth is that actually, you know, you are you and you have to put your pants on in the morning and you do have a certain pigmentation and you will be viewed in a certain way and you will view others in a certain way.
That's
A mature spiritual practice deals with both.
That's correct. That's well said.
Yeah. I try.
Yeah, I think you're a teacher.
I don't know about that,
but
especially not on this subject, because I really feel like I'm at the beginning of a very steep learning curve.
Yeah, and we're all learning. And that's another reality around this. We're in different places with the waking up piece around race and racial harm and injury. You know, I was just talking at the Zen Center.
The New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care.
Right. I was doing a talk there and a woman of color raised a question about, you know, how do you deal with just the fact that so many of our Buddhist institutions are so white and so segregated, and how do you work with that? And I get so tired of seeing that. And what I said to her is, how can they not be that? I mean, you know, you have to look at our conditioning. Most institutions, most organizations that are organized by white people does not take into consideration people of color from the start. It's just not in the consciousness. And what happens when there is no examination of racial group identity or whiteness, then the same individualistic mindset, I'm a good person, I'm a good, you know, I'm a good white person even, but it's individual, not collective. That same consciousness rolls itself into the institution, into the organization.
Or that same lack of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. And so it, to me, it's not a matter of whether these institutions are have racism. How could they not? The issue is, what do you do about that? What do you do with your privilege? What do you do with this once you wake up to it? And how do you not go back to sleep? How do you not just kind of just ride on the privilege and the all of the benefits that come with, just the privilege of having power like that? What do you do with the power? What do you do with the privilege? What do you do with the waking up? You know,
I have so many questions I want to ask you. I've become very interested recently in the issue of bias, and I'm writing a new book about all the ways in which we are kind or unkind, and I'm specifically looking at my own lack of kindness. And I want to look at bias, and I'll get to the question. This is just a long-winded way of asking a question, but I'm interested in my bias on lots of levels, racial bias, but also political, ideological bias. And so I've really made it my business of late to start listening to podcasts on all ends of the political spectrum. And as part of that, I've been listening to conservatives who argue, for a reason I can't fully understand, because I'm still at the beginning of my research, but they argue that white privilege is a myth. I don't agree with that. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that white privilege is real. But what would you say to somebody who can't, who was arguing that white? For example, Jordan Peterson is a very popular guy right now, and I haven't watched his YouTube speech on this, but there's a whole thing about white privilege not being real. Ben Shapiro has a similar argument.
Right.
What is? I wish I could. It's a little bit of an unfair question because I can't reproduce their arguments.
I don't have to know their arguments, because it's a real common, posture, a common thing that white people would say. I don't know a lot of people of color saying there's no such thing as white privilege, which is a piece of why this is so significant.
And they would argue, just so you know, their argument is, well, that's, kind of a victim mentality, et cetera, et cetera.
I understand. So for me, what I would I have this rubric. And
Rubik's Cube.
This Rubik's Cube, and I talk about the racial awareness rubric.
You have it in your hand right
I
now.
I have it in my hand right now. The first pair is around what we've talked about a little bit, which is individual and then racial group identity. White people tend to focus at the level of individual. This is also where bias is, at the individual level. So we all have biases. White people, all people have biases. We're all part of racial group identities. Some of us know that. Some of us don't. Some of us buy that. Some of us don't. Most people of color get that they're part of a racial group identity. Most white people relate to themselves as individuals. This is crucial. The second pair is on dominant and subordinated group dynamics, races. White people are a dominant race. This is where privilege lives. It lives in the collective. It doesn't live at the individual level. Most white people I know would not describe themselves as privileged, because we know there's only this 1%. I mean, it has a lot to do with how you're defining what privilege is. But privilege, white skin privilege, is this ability to acknowledge that you're a race or not, engage around race or not, and there's not really a lot of consequence around it. You can flip it off, you can turn it off. That in itself is white privilege. But it's mostly the denial that you're part of a collective that is on top, that is in a dominating role in this society. So the only way to understand privilege is to understand group identity. The reason that's not understood is because group identity has not been vetted among white people. There has not been a coming together to examine the historic, pervasive inheritances of whiteness that exist at the collective level. To me, that's the missing piece. So we can hang out at bias, We can hang out at individual opinions. That's all individual. It's still not the work at the racial group identity level. That's still an itch and a scratch for white people. And I think the question needs to be, why is it so hard to go there?
I want people to read the book, so we don't need to. I don't want to get you to say everything that's in the book, but can you just talk a little bit about the sort of the basic thesis and structure of Mindful of Race?
Yeah, it's kind of like this Rubik that I'm talking about, even though the Rubik as a symbol didn't come up until after I wrote the book. But the first part of the book is really the belief. So what we're doing with this book is we're intersecting mindfulness meditation and meditation principles rooted in Buddhist teachings, but not all of them. We're integrating this kind of technology, if you will, with recognizing and being able to understand racial distress and injury. So the first part of the book is really allowing people to really diagnose the issue, to diagnose their racial conditioning. And it's really sharing these first two pairs on the Rubik of understanding yourself as an individual, understanding yourself as a racial group member, and it also is talking about the dynamics of dominating and subordinated racial groups. There's a pattern. There's constellations we can begin to recognize. The book offers six hindrances to racial harmony that we can begin to notice both internally and externally in the world and to make some choices around. And so these are very important, ways of looking at how you have been conditioned around relating to race, both yourself and to others. So that's important. That's not so much Buddhist teachings. That's teachings more from the work I've done in understanding race, racism, and power dynamics within my corporate and community work. And then the second part of the work, the book, is really speaking to meditation, specifically establishing a meditation practice where you can work with the distress that you feel internally in diving into this inquiry of race and racism, especially your own conditioning. And it offers a daily meditation practice, how to develop a relationship with being at ease so that you can bear witness to all of the rise and fall of craziness that happens as we start to pay attention to our mind when we start looking at race, the way we think, our habits of mind, the shame, the blame, the guilt, the rage, all these things that come up in the mind, how the body collapses. So we're learning how to kind of be with this this weather, landscape, seasons of internal experience inside the heart, body, and mind, and learning how to forgive ourselves. We're learning about compassion. We're learning about kindness. We're learning about rain, recognizing, allowing, investigating, and nurturing distress that moves through the heart and mind. So a lot of instruction on how to just be with the tension and aversion and, the ways we distract ourselves is in part two of the book, which is meditation, which really is the intervention. I talk about racism as a heart disease, and it's curable. It's curable through, to a large extent, the intervention of mindfulness that's supporting a certain inner atmosphere that allows us to respond more wisely to the distress in ourselves and in the world.
And to see clearly first.
And to see clearly. That's a really good point. And then the third part of the book is really speaking to a culture of care. And this is looking at our interdependence, the way we are part of something larger than ourselves. And I have a lot of fun in this section because I have a chapter on how to talk about what disturbs you, which is some really pointed instructions where a good third of the instruction is about turning your attention inward, to deal with your own distress. And there's a section on equanimity, and not just equanimity that we learn about how to, again, that Buddha, the five-story golden Buddha, just the posture of sitting and staying in your seat with a sense of dignity and awareness and full-heartedness. So I'm talking about not just our capacity to do that, that we gain some of the fruits from sitting meditation, but also our there's a social equanimity that we can concern ourselves with, the gifting, the extending of our practice to the communities that we live in and our families. There's also a chapter in that section on artistry as cultural medicine, and how when we are involved in some kind of artistic expression that's natural for us, we're really kind of being, we find more aliveness and more creativity and more joy in our lives when we have tumbled into the territory of creating and offering. I think if we weren't in the struggle of racial tension, we'd be creating, we'd be dancing more, singing more, be more light in our hearts around what's possible, because I think our energy would be a bit more purified and cleaned to leaning towards what's possible instead of what's wrong.
Finally, let me just ask you, let me exercise my privilege as the host of the show, gets that privilege to sit and talk to you. What advice would you give me as a white male who has enormous privilege, you know, economic privilege, I have a public platform. How could somebody with my everything that I've been given and in the position that I'm in, what do you think somebody like me can do to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem?
That's a really good question, Dan. And I'm taking that to heart. Because sometimes the suggestions I have for people like this, you know, is not always well received. One hope that I
have. Let me have it. I don't care.
One hope that I have. Let me share a story with a guy who I worked with that was very senior in a bank. And I think it was the Florida hurricanes hit, the ones just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. He decided to take a crew on his own. You know, he hired a couple of trucks and took a crew of people down there to help clear out some communities because the mold and the environment had gotten so toxic for a lot of people. He ended up right in the heart of a black community and was in with a woman who was a hoarder. And so there was all these papers and things stacked up to that she still couldn't get rid of, even though it was all damaged from the hurricane. And so he's counseling her and telling her. And meanwhile, the crew is with her consent, clearing things out. And in the middle of that, his boss called and said, you know, you're in violation of a company policy. You need to return the work right away. And he said to them, when you can come down here and see what I'm seeing and not do what I'm doing, then we can have a conversation. And he stayed. And there wasn't any real repercussions from that choice that he made. But I was intrigued with him because he made a choice that was not so much his job, but it was a use of his privilege to take care of something that he saw, and he organized it and took care of it. I think those are ways that people in positions, you know, they can push the bar on authority. I mean, it could have been the case where his job would have been at risk, but it really wasn't. And I think he maybe knew that to some extent.
Maybe it would have been at risk if he wasn't white?
It could very well have been at risk if he wasn't white. But I don't know that. I'm looking at what he did. I'm looking at what you can do in terms of, you know, being able to push that bar when people of color can't. You know, I also think that there's a collusion dynamic among white people that includes blindness, sameness, and silence. I think white people in positions like you're in can break the, you know, the collusive dynamics of not speaking about race, not confronting race, you know, turning a blind eye. You know, you can be the person that's just not having it, you know. And I, so that's another thing, you know, you can, you know, there, I mean, I'm sure you run into many situations where the thought arises and maybe it's not spoken, but it could be. It could be an interesting practice to see what it's like to be different in a sea of white, powerful people, to raise these issues, to work with the itch and scratch of that, to be different, because there is a white collective. It's just not claimed. And you, but you know what it is when you start doing things that are outside of it. You know, and I think a third thing is to one of the things I really advocate in the book is forming racial affinity groups. I mean, what would it be like if you and one or two other white guys got together and committed to unpacking this thing called whiteness and really understanding it more intimately? What is it? What is our conditioning? I mean, really keeping the focus inward on how we've been conditioned to not be membered, and what is the consequence of that? I think this is a life's work, and it's not about fixing as much as it's about understanding how we've been tightly conditioned to stay in our lanes and not question how we got here.
There's so much. As I see, I'm going to be a... I'm going to be careful about what I'm about to say, although the fact that I'm being careful says a lot, because there's a lot of fear about talking about this issue.
Exactly, yeah.
But I just finished taking a class, online class, through the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, an organization I highly recommend, B-A-R-R-E, Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. Your name came up a lot, and it was an online course on race and the Dharma, taught by... four teachers, two of whom have been on the show, Sebane Selassie. I'm having a temporary...
Do you have Brian Lesage?
No, the another female.
Joanna Hardy.
Joanna Hardy, yeah, who was also a teacher on the 10% Happier app. Mm-hmm. She used to be named Joanna Harper, but now she's Joanna Hardy.
Yes.
And I found it to be incredibly interesting, the course. And we did do all these readings, and... There was one reading on something called white fragility that I had never actually heard of before, and it was written by a white person. It talked about how the fact that you're familiar with this, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but I'm talking to our listeners here. That white people, when confronted with the things that you've been talking about, which is that we are a racial group and that we do have privilege, often we get super fragile around that. We get angry or defensive. That struck me as true, but I also got the sense that it puts white people in a double bind, because if I question anything, then I'm being fragile. If I say, if I do the uncomfortable thing of questioning any statement that's being made when we start talking about the structures of racism in the United States, maybe I'm just being defensive. Maybe I just won't look at the thing. And I fear that at times, so you have the vast majority of people who don't want to talk about this at all, and that's the bigger problem. But even in the smaller groups where people are willing to address this stuff, I think there's another issue, which is we white people get so cowed that we turn off our critical thinking a little bit. And we, I think we, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but I do notice a dynamic where I see among my fellow white people a sort of this mode of just overwhelming contrition, some of which is totally warranted, but I don't know if it's fully thought through in some cases. And
What do you mean not thought through?
Well, everything is just so. For example, I noticed that when I would question, even in this paper, there's a seminal paper on white fragility, and it basically there are all these footnotes in it, and it looks like an academic paper. But I'm not sure that just because it's an academic paper that everything in there is true. I actually think White Fidelity, having read it, I thought this is mostly spot on. But there were some parts of it I was like, nah, is that true? I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
And but am I allowed in this situation to ask that question?
Yeah, I see.
That's
what you're
dynamic
saying.
I'm trying to get at.
And
can you have real dialogue if the white people in these situations are just trying not to get in trouble?
Oh,
that's what I'm getting at.
Exactly. This is a really important point that you're bringing up. Let me say a couple of things. I'm familiar with Dr. Robin DiAngelo's work. She's one of the endorsers on my book. I think she's doing some really important stuff here. We don't have to agree with all of it. I think there's a difference between fragility and vulnerability. I think this term she coined is really trying to get at something very specific about white people, which is, I think, the fragility of the way I understand it is this fragility that happens when you're not in control. Things are not perfect, and you're feeling vulnerable. You know that these things start happening. So I think she's trying to really nail something that people of color have been talking about a long time, but wouldn't have quite called it fragility. We would call it, you know, privilege and a number of things. So she's getting into the whole emotional territory and the ways we hide out or can escape. The exit doors that white people can take and do take right in the heart of the vulnerability of engagement around it. So that's one piece of it. But the piece I think that's so potent about what you're saying, Dan, is here's how I would say it. If I can't argue from my experience as a white man with people of color, if I can't talk about what that's like for me, if I can't disagree without being then seen as blah, 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 or of not really being a good white ally or not being somebody that's really listening, then what is this? Do I just roll over and be run over? Or do I get to have a voice? Do I get to screw it up? Do I get to learn if I'm really, you know, can I learn without, can I learn in the ways that I learn? You know, and I think these are really important things. I think a real compliment. See, I think there's a few steps. The step of white people doing their work together is crucial, because when you start unpacking the way you're describing in this way, well, I don't see it that way, or I have feelings, or I have this point of view. When that discussion starts unraveling or opening, and there hasn't been work around whiteness, then a lot of the unawareness that might go with that ends up having to be pointed out, because there is a collective dynamic that's pervasive in the social realm. That's a piece of that you swim in. That is also a piece of the mix. So when that's not incorporated into the dialogue, this sense of understanding whiteness and how it could be also engaged in the very thought that you're having, the expression that you're, you know, when that's not a piece of it, then you're speaking as an individual absent of rootedness and whiteness. And I think that's where it can go downhill. Mm-hmm. So it's real important that this kind of collective piece is engaged and well understood, because otherwise, you know, it's having to be how it lives. It's never going to be perfect. Again, it's messy at best, but it is going to be recognized and respected when white people start, bring your charge, bring your energy, but also bring your history, bring your group identity. You know, you're not just some individual with a point of view. You've been conditioned and whiteness, and that's the piece that's missing, I feel, in our engagement. But I do think the challenge is important. I think it's a real compliment when white people, you know, are firm in what they're bringing. But they need to be educated and where they're coming from.
A compliment how?
A compliment
they're showing
that you're
the respect.
Yeah, you're standing. This is my experience. I've done my work over here. I'm bringing this experience. I don't know if I agree with that or, you know, whatever it might be. I don't know what it is. But I think being willing to get in the rough of it and have a real dialogue with people of color is not, you know, that's my hope. But I think there's some work that white people need to do before they bring to that.
Rather than either hiding out, denying it, or being condescending and pretending I agree with everything
that's
you're
right.
saying.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's really patronizing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's not what we want. There is a place of deep listening and hearing, which is part of the educational piece. And you do have to know your buttons and when you're getting defensive, because we all have defense patterns and ways that we protect ourselves. We have to know when that's playing. People of color don't always know when that's playing, right? So it's messy, you know, but I think the piece that we all need to really bring to these discussions is a sense of ourselves as individuals and as racial group identities.
She's got the Rubik's Cube again.
I'm holding it. This is it. This is it.
Before we go, let's do the plugging that I like to do. So give me a sense. Name every book you've written. Tell us what where you are on social media, what your website is. Give me everything.
Okay. Well, this is my second book. The first book was Healing Rage, Women Making Inner Peace Possible. This book is Mindful of Race, Transforming Racism from the Inside Out. I've got a few audio meditation books, one around rage. I have a DVD on cultural competency that's available as a download and a bunch of stuff. I have these wristbands, Mindful of Race.
Where can we get them?
Not there yet. All on my website. I have one
Which is
RuthKing.net.
Okay.
And the book is there. The products are there. The recordings are there. A number of recordings. Guided meditations are there. Resource pages on racial awareness is there. Guidelines on forming a racial affinity group is there. Upcoming retreats and meditation retreats, mindful of race retreats. A lot is there. The website is a good resource.
Very grateful to you for coming in here and spending some time. Appreciate
it. This is so great. Thank you. Thank you to your community. Appreciate it.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohen, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.